Okay, while you're still all fired up by our speakers, I think we'll go straight into questions. We've got a lot of people here tonight, so can you, if you wish to ask a question of either of the speakers, can you give me a show of hands? If I see you, I will recognize you, and I will do my best, if there's a lot of questions, to actually allow you to speak in order. As I say, I'll do my best, but if there's a lot of questions, just kind of prompt me if I've missed you out. Okay?
Actually, if I may ask, since he addressed some of the things specifically, and it looks like he's waiting for an answer, and
yeah.
I think the public is waiting for an answer. So if I don't give that, you know.
Okay, well, we decided we wouldn't do that, but if you want to do that, I'm quite happy to do that. The alternative is that we actually ask you to speak at the end of the session. Which would you prefer?
Well, I think it'd be best to answer the
Okay,
questions now,
that's fine.
Because then people will ask more relevant questions.
Okay, let me just ask Clifford. Are you okay with that?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so how much do you think? How much time do you think?
Not much, but he said lots of things, so I'll try to be brief.
Okay, should we give you 10 minutes each?
Yeah.
You may not want to use that, but we'll give you 10 minutes each. Is that all right? Okay, all right, go ahead.
Okay, so thank you, Cliff. So you mentioned inequality at the beginning with lots of statistics, which, by the way, I also talk about in my book, which, by the way, is available for free on the website. So here's a copy if you want to buy it and support me, but you don't have to because it's free too. It's open source. You say that the real issue is that the future doesn't belong to us and that I'm neglecting to taking that into account. I may not have been very explicit about this, but I'm actually, my initial point is because that is the premise, I'm proposing something else. And the reason is, I don't think you can change the whole of society by waiting for the majority of the population to agree with you somehow and then move towards a different kind of system right on the spot or in a very short amount of time. I think you innovate your way out of your problems, right? Step by step. You know, one step after the other. You make a plan, you start scientific process, right? You do something, it works, it doesn't, you pivot, and then you do something else, it works better. Lots of other people, they see how you are living better, and they want to emulate you, right? They want to live like you. And so you keep growing and it becomes viral. And so you lead by example. And I think that's the way you do things. You fight control with openness. You fight scarcity with abundance. And you fight centralization with decentralization. That's the way you're going to get out of this capitalist system that aggregates all the power and all the resources. So you mentioned, how did they get all that money? Well, the top 0.1% got all that money because we are consumers of a system and we keep buying things. That's the reason they got all that money. If you stop being a cog in that system, then they cannot get all that money and aggregate it, because technologies become decentralized, energy becomes decentralized, resources become decentralized, food becomes decentralized. Suddenly, whatever you need to survive is more and more locally available, locally produced, locally shared. Therefore, you reduce their power because you reduce the source of the power, which is the source of the problem. The source of the problem is not politica. Politics is the consequence of this system, because it was more efficient to have a capitalist system in an economy than it was to have a socialist system or a socialist-like system. Because I know you guys, you say Lenin, forget about that, nothing to do with us. Stalin, nothing to do with us. But what I'm talking about is the socialist-like system or the state capitalist system that was in Russia. And those kind of systems were less efficient than the capitalist system. And that's why they failed.
China is an example of China.
Exactly. China became a capitalist system because it was more efficient to be like that. So you have to think of the processes that create situations in society. And how did Carlos Slim become the wealthiest man on the planet? Well, by managing and owning communications companies. Well, what if those communication technologies were shared and open source, right? What if the frequencies were open source? What if the technologies that used those frequencies were open source and shared? Those hundreds of billions of dollars could not have gravitated towards one single person because it would have been structurally impossible. So the reason we have aggregation of power is because we give all of our power, which is our money that we get from the jobs that we have, to the corporations, right? So that's how you create inequality, because then you have a vicious cycle where it's easier to, you know, buy out some senators than to convince. That's why socialism, I think, it's unreasonable to believe that somehow 51% of the population will have a change of consciousness and vote for a socialist society without a transition of some sort with a specific plan that, you know, pivots and follows the scientific method. Because it's easier to convince 100 senators to do your bidding if you are a multinational corporation with billions of dollars than to convince hundreds of millions of people to vote for you. Right? So I'm not neglecting it. That is my starting point. That is the beginning of my argument. And my question is, how do we operate and act in a way that takes away that kind of power? Because that's the only way you're going to change society, by working on the processes that create situations. So who's going to, and then a few things about the technological employment argument. Who's going to build, design, and repair these robots? For a little while, people, and then machines will become smarter than us and they can build and repair themselves. Some machines are also self-repairing to some extent. NASA is experimenting with robots that self-repair and self-construct to have naval bases, to have bases on the moon and on Mars. Elon Musk is working on this. I was at NASA a few months ago, last summer. I studied there, I was doing research, and I spoke with these guys, and I know the technologies that are behind this. So for a little while, you have humans, but the difference is 10 programmers and 5 designers can outsource. I mean, they can take out of a job 100 million people. So yes, you do need humans for a little while, maybe 20, 30 years top. But the difference is you employ 5 and you displace 5 million. That's the kind of difference. So yes, the past predictions didn't turn out to be true. Unemployment is not proportional. I agree with your argument. What you said something and then you said, this is preposterous. I agree, it's preposterous. And nobody has ever made that argument. So it's a straw man argument. I initially said that what happened in the past didn't displace people because the technologies were not advanced enough so that we had time to adjust and find new jobs. But now that things are moving very more rapidly, and they will move even more rapidly in the future, because machines, you know, before they actually, you know, they displace somebody doing something, you know, repetitive like ch-ch-ch-ch-ch. Okay, you replace that and you can do, you know, some desk job. You replace that and you can do something else. You can be a designer, whatever. What if you have a machine who's better than you at everything? What else are you going to do? Nothing. So, and then they say, oh, but, you know, this genius designer or this genius whatever, you never replace that guy. Okay, he's one in a million. Most of the people. So my question that I pose to every economist, every futurist, and every person I've talked to, and I've talked to some of the smartest people on the planet, what is the 50-year-old truck driver going to do in 20 years when he's going to be replaced by the automobiles that are self-driving? Or they're going to do another job, like what? I don't know, gardening? Well, that's going to be replaced too, because, you know, if they replace that, they're going to, oh, he's going to do another job. What kind of job? Is he going to become, I don't know, a biotechnologist in 5 years? Or is that's preposterous to believe that in the United States alone, there is 3.8 million people, I think, that drive for a living. Right, that's like 2.6% of the population. Like there are hundreds of millions of people in the world who drive for a living. What are they going to do? they haven't been taught to be programmers and, you know, industrial designers and structural engineer. Yes?
I got an answer for this. I think because we can have a different kind of products, so you can have the handmade product and the one made by the machine.
Agree, but it's going to be a fringe minority. It's not going to be, it's not going to make a dent in the whole of the market, right? So you create 10 jobs, you displace a million. It's always the same thing. And the unemployment graph, which is correct, and I know that graph, is misleading because it actually is not showing the number of people employed compared to the total population. Because that doesn't count the people who have stopped looking for a job because they just gave up. It doesn't take into account the people who haven't been looking for a job for more than 3 years because that's out of the calculation. So that, even though it's true, it's very misleading because the real number, if you look at the graph, corporate profits, which I have in my book and my website, corporate profits are like this over the last 25 years. The number of people employed relative to the total population is going like this. So that's the real graph. That's the one you have to use. And that's going down and down and down, and there is no dent up ever. And there are no cycles. It's just going down. And corporate profits are going up. That's the real graph. Next, social relationships. Sir, what?
Excuse me. We'll take questions later if you don't mind. Otherwise, we... Yep. Okay, thank you.
So, loss of social relationships. Exactly. Exactly my point. Because we go to work 8 hours a day in a job we most likely hate, the Luwachi thing that says as much as 80% of the people hate their job. Then you come home, you're kind of exhausted, and you watch TV, you become couch potato, right? And you never talk to your neighbor. What if you don't have to work to survive because you can produce what you need through open source technologies that are distributed and decentralized? Then you've got time to, you know, share the food that you just produce with your neighbor. Go to your local community, help the elderly or the disabled, do some voluntary work, work on an open source project, spend time with your kids. Rediscover the sense of community. Exactly my point. So I agree with you, loss of social relationships. And the solution to this is to rediscover the sense of community, which, you know, communism, community, and share ideas, share resources, share your time. Beautiful things can come out of that. But if you have to spend 8 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, working on something that's not really helping anyone except the top 0.1% get more money, because the money you're going to receive, you're going to spend it somewhere to survive, you see, you have to break the cycle. That's the reason we have this inequality. And the only way you can get out of that is to break the cycle. And breaking the cycle, I think, this is one way. And I think this is not the only way and not the best way, but I think this is one way. And if we have a scientific approach, we start with this. And then we say, look, the point you made, you know, in page 54 is not really working out. Because I actually tried it. I found out that something else is better. Awesome. Tell me about it. I'll make the change. Next book is going to be better. And, you know, we actually make a plan that works because you iterate the process. Next.
Federica, I'm just concerned that we leave time for people to get questions.
One last thing. Why can't we share all the resources now instead? It's a nice idea, but the reason is social inertia. You've got this huge inertia that you cannot fight with wishful thinking. You have to fight with a process that changes, that reverses the flow. And I think, yeah, that's it.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Federica. Clifford?
I'm going to try to limit my comments to a maximum of 5 minutes at this point because then we really do want to hand over to the floor. I apologise to Federico if I misrepresented his position in relation to the prediction of unemployment following the exponential graph. If his predictions, however, are proved correct, and we do have, let's just say, much greater numbers of unemployed than we're used to, perhaps, if I can put it that way. The idea, for example, now we have, roughly 3 million unemployed in this country, give or take. You know, if we envisage a situation in the near future where that figure was 4 million, 5 million, 6 million, what would the implications of that be? unemployment within capitalist society, as we experience it today, is a form of modern slavery. You know, you're living on that 60 or 70 pounds a week in an environment where it takes a lot more than that to live even half decently. So it's a form of modern slavery. That's the prospect that we look at for millions and millions of people, perhaps several million, if he's right. If, however, we create a socialist form of society, then it's fantastically good news, because we know then we can use technology, we can use the lack of necessity to use so many people in just creating food and shelter for all of us. It means that we can create more leisure, we can create more community-based activities. So it really does pinpoint the importance of building a socialist society so that we can make the most of technology as it is. We do have a precedent for how this can come about if we look briefly at the capitalist revolution. When capitalism first came into being, it was in the same way. The power to produce social wealth, the technology, if you like, had outstripped the social relationships which then existed. The feudal ties, the system of feudalism, was appropriate to a given level of productive power. And those feudal relationships of the Middle Ages, the medieval social relationships, if you like, of production, had outlived their usefulness and had to go. But it wasn't actually done, although it took a while for it to happen, it certainly wasn't done by half measures. When, for example, the capitalist traders realised that in order to benefit their interests, they had to, for example, in this British context, had to abolish the Corn Laws, they didn't talk about half abolishing them or talk about doing their trade with some other scraps somewhere else. They knew that they had a goal, that they had to create a modern capitalist society, and they were willing to do whatever it took. And in fact, the socialist revolution, with even greater reason, will be something which is unified and brief when it happens, because it's about the consciousness of the vast majority creating for the first time a classless society. All previous social revolutions have replaced one form of class domination with another, whereas the socialist revolution is different because it gets rid of class. And in that sense, it can actually have a greater degree of unity than the earlier revolutions would have done. I'm just going to say finally, if you think about these different approaches to change, for example, Federico is saying that we can't sort of wait to have this majority who agree with us and then to enact this great change. No, he says instead we have to lead by example, step by step, and then hope that people will emulate, do things on a smaller scale, this kind of thing. I think that's wishful thinking. I think that's unrealistic because of the way that capitalist society operates. And I'm sure we can debate that more later this evening. But for now, I'd like to finish this contribution of mine before we hand over to the floor by asking a simple question. We spoke about some of these incredibly powerful individuals earlier. And let's not be unfair and just pick on poor Carlos Slim. There are many others. I would just want to ask myself this question and to ask you this question. If one of these frighteningly powerful individuals was sat right here now, listening to this debate, which policy, which system of thought would he, Carlos Slim, feel more comfortable with? Which would he feel more safe with? Which would he actually be more likely to vote for at the end this evening? It's pretty clear to me, from where I'm standing, I know which of the two points of view he would feel safer and more comfortable with.
Okay, thank you both. Can I have a show of hands for questions, please? This gentleman here.
Yeah, one factor that hasn't been considered, I think it's quite relevant. A question raised...
Speakers speak up so as we can hear.
Do you want me to stand up? Yeah. There's a great futurist called Richard Buckminster Fuller, who in the 70s raised the possibility of technological unemployment, and he said that what he foresaw happening, and I think is happening to some degree, is governments progressively passing more and more legislation just as a pretext for creating more and more bureaucratic jobs. And he spoke about a time when pretty soon we'll have a situation where all the productive jobs in the production and distribution of things people need will be increasingly done by mechanisation. What we'll have is armies of inspectors, inspectors of inspectors, people who make the badges for the inspectors of inspectors, a whole house of cards of pointless bureaucratic jobs supported by bureaucratic legislation as a pretext for employing people whose jobs are actually fairly socially pointless, just to disguise and hide the fact that so many people have become technologically unemployed. So how far advanced do you think we are down that road?
What's your answer to that first?
Okay. Yep. So I actually have that whole sentence in my book, and I presented it in my TED talk. And the thing is, he also said that the future of society should be full unemployment, so that we can play. That's why we have to destroy the present political-economic system. And Bucky Fuller was a visionary, but he was also a scientist, and he understood processes. And as such, I don't think in the future we're going to have necessarily full unemployment because of the way the system works. I can imagine a plethora of futures where you've got useless jobs that people just do that have no meaning just because they have to be employed, such as just having lots of bureaucratic jobs just to keep the system running. So the question that I'm posing here in the book is really, why do we do that? Like, can we put into question the idea of working itself? Can we imagine a society where we don't have to work to survive? That's my whole point. Where we can live a decent life with everything we need without having to work. So some people, I mean...
Work for others, you mean?
What?
Work for others. Because anyway, you have to work
Excuse me, just one question at a time, thank you. If you want to speak, if you want to ask a question, can you put up your hand, please?
Okay. So some countries are already trying to put a 20-hour work week, right? Right now in Italy, the Five Star Movement, which now is the biggest political party in the lower chamber, they're talking about how do we get to, you know, a zero-hour work week in 50 years? That's the kind of reasoning that I want to see from the political power.
Just very briefly, I'd like to say that we mustn't avoid confusing work with employment. Work is the expenditure of energy to a given goal. And in a social context, we can have the scientific definition of work, which is just purely the spending of energy. But in a social context, when we're working, we're spending energy in order to achieve something. So people work on doing their garden or something, or doing a hobby is a kind of work. But very distinct from work is employment, which is otherwise known as wage labour, or to use the often coined phrase, wage slavery. And you hear this phrase, wage slavery. I even heard it on Coronation Street once. It's in popular use now, even though it's seen as a Marxist slogan. But actually, most people who go out to work for a living will understand exactly what's meant by that. Wage slavery. We're tied to earning our wage or our salary. It's the same thing. A salary is just a monthly wage. And we're tied to that. And we never seem to have enough to get by. We certainly don't have enough to save very much money from that. So it is a form of slavery because we keep having to go back for more. And when I said earlier about social relationships, I really wanted to focus particularly on that relationship, the relationship between employer and employee. And that's the one that has to be got rid of. And to go back to the questioner, of course we have all kinds of jobs within capitalism that are meaningless and pointless. And it just comes back to Federico's point that we have the technology now to do all the wonderful things we need to do in society with very little time input for the basic tasks. We could have a society organised technologically and scientifically and rationally in which all of us just work for 2 or 3 hours a day. That's realistic across the world. And we would be able to provide all the things we need. Mm-hmm. That's the goal we're looking at. But at the risk of being like a parrot and repeating myself, I have to say again, that will only really be a prospect, a realistic prospect, if we first deal with this problem, this thorny problem of ownership, which is that we have the political and economic control of resources, the really important resources, by the tiny minority. And that's where we keep hitting against this wall. All the things we would love to do with technology, all of the useful work we'd like to be doing, keeps being held out of our reach. And all of the stupid things and the pointless tasks, and we haven't even mentioned the military today, but I mean all the enormous resources that goes into designing and making modern weapons of war, really, really huge resources. Again, such a waste of human potential. These things can only end when their rationale ends, which is right at the root, is the capitalist system itself.
Okay. First, second, third, fourth. your question. Can I ask, there's potentially a lot of questions here, so can I ask members of the meeting, please to keep your questions brief. I understand you may need to give some background, but keep them as brief as you can, and speakers also, if you can just keep your responses brief, please.
Yes, Federico, to address the point that's been raised by the other speaker, in your encounters with as you go around the world, as you talk to people well-placed in the industry, whether they're in Google or Microsoft or wherever, do you find that they're very much afraid of this possible future in which the people are working fewer and fewer hours, or are they open to it, and are they willing to embrace this kind of a large-scale transformation of society?
They're very willing to embrace this kind of society, and they're very open. In fact, Peter Diamandis, who's a multimillionaire and CEO of multinational corporations, he's founder of the XPRIZE and so on and so forth. He read my book. He said he loved it. And during a conference organized by the Wall Street Journal just a couple of weeks ago, he said, "I'm a hardcore capitalist, liberal capitalist in my heart, but I think we're moving towards a future of socialism, and that's fine." And he said that after reading my book, and he's a multimillionaire.
Okay, hang on. No, sorry. One question at a time, please. Do you want to respond to it? Okay. This gentleman here.
Do you think that actually there might be a mutual relationship between both of your arguments here, and that actually a spread of communication, information, technology will actually help to spread the memes, if you will, towards the surrounding culture to basically usurp these capitalists that sit at the top of our society? So actually maybe your arguments are one of the same thing?
No.
To a certain degree, at least. Don't we have to utilise technology and the internet to help communication to spread to actually the masses, so that the masses feel inclined to actually take these people off their perch, so to speak? I think that's a perfectly reasonable argument, much as Federico's one, that we have to, of course, as Buckminster Fuller once said, he said, if you want to make something obsolete, you have to build it, you have to do something technical to make it obsolete, so you don't have to use it anymore. And this guy controls the media, right? So the internet is open source media and open source production of facilities for our life and our communities. So we do both. It's gone.
I think there is, of course, there is some common ground between our positions, and we have to try to build on that. But I think there are also some really very important differences, and we have to look at those as well. Yes, we all use the means at our disposal to spread our ideas. Everybody does. And so, of course, we as socialists, we use the internet and we use any form of communication that we can. But then the question is, when you're actually putting out that publicity or that message, what does it actually say? You know, and I've looked at all of Federico's stuff. I've also looked at the Zeitgeist stuff. And, I mean, there are plenty of interesting videos, interviews, lots of stuff that Federico's got out there online. And it's interesting, but I would like to urge him, when he's getting these opportunities, to speak more about how we're actually going to deal with this problem of ownership. And we are saying very different things, because basically when challenged by interviewers online to explain what the change is, or how we make the change, or what the path is to the future, Federico will answer that it's important for people to have a change of attitude, to think differently about, on a small scale, about whether they're going to, whether money is going to be less important. I mean, for example, in one interview, he was asked very specifically whether money has a role in the future, and he said yes for certain things. Well, I mean, here you're going to get a very different answer from a socialist, because we would say absolutely not. As long as there is any existence of money, that is solid proof that you have social relationships of ownership. And we're actually advocating a society without social relationships of ownership at all. So there can't be money. Money is a means of exchange when somebody owns something and somebody else doesn't. We don't want that. That's the root of the problem. So, I mean, I could go on, but yes, there are important differences which need to be looked at.
So I think there is a lot of common ground, actually. And the one thing that I would disagree on is the root of the problem. I don't think the root of the problem is the capitalist system. I think the capitalist system is the consequence of something else. And you keep referring to that as the source of the problem without realizing that that was built. And we came to that point because of a set of circumstances that led to that thing to happen, because it was the most stable and efficient system for a specific purpose. Now, what you can do is you can change the purpose, right? So the purpose of an economy, if the purpose is the economy growing, then the most efficient way is the capitalist system, because that's what works. If your purpose is not just to grow the economy and to have, you know, conspicuous consumption and planned obsolescence and all these kind of nonsensical things, if your goal is to maximize people's happiness, is to maximize well-being, is to maximize social relations, then you're going to take a different route, like the open source and the open source philosophy in general. And just as a proof that incremental steps do actually work, when we started 6 years ago doing activism in Italy, everybody thought we were crazy. Okay, I was one of the first people, together with many others, to start the five-star movement. 3 years ago, when we ran for a regional election, we got 0.8%, and everybody laughed at us. Now, we've got 26%, and we are the biggest political party in the country. And we are proposing legislation and changes in society which very much resonate with what the Socialist Party proposes. So you can make a change, and guess what? We use the internet. We use open source philosophy. That's how we got. We led by example. We went into regional elections, into the cities. We showed how you can actually do things better. And the people who live in that region and in those cities, they saw that somebody was leading by example. And then they said, I'm going to put my trust in these people and in this kind of system because I see that it works better. Because I can see it. I can touch it. It's part of my daily life. And it's part of a process. And that is the only way you can actually have a change in society on a large scale. And eventually you can reach, you know, 51% for the whole world.
Okay. Thank you for your for the debate, very interesting. I just want to do a question about this comparison between the socialist approach and the Federico approach. Socialist, I think, is much more, there is a destruction than socialist philosophy. So the philosophy of socialism is quite old, has a long history. There are hundreds of philosophers, hundreds of thinkers, hundreds of books, and I think it's something that is I can consider stable, because it's a kind of philosophy that many people try to explain, and also our today we explain, I think, very well. About the philosophy of Federico, philosophy or ideas or proposals, Federico, I think there are some points, some aspects that are very similar to socialism ideas. Like, I appreciate a lot the analysis. The first part, what Federico says, is very interesting. So, is how?
Sorry, can I ask you to move to a question?
Yeah. Okay. But the question is in the end.
So yeah, but if you
okay.
There are a lot more people who want to speak.
Yeah, okay. Okay.
Send a tweet.
Okay, Federico, in what he said that, talk about the movement, five-star movement. But he also said, I have seen also a video, very nice video, and this is the reason why I'm here today, that Federico make a critics, very interesting critics to this movement. So I would like that Federico speak more about the criticism to this movement, because it's the reason why I'm here, because okay. I appreciate Federico for the critics, not because Federico is part of the movement, because Federico, in very intelligent way, here.
I think we have your question, actually.
Okay, this is the question is that Federico, please speak more about that.
Okay.
And also the question is, Federico, are
you
ready?
One question, please. Yeah.
Are you ready to work to live without job? Are you ready tomorrow morning?
Okay. So I'll answer the second question. I'll answer the second question first. I quit my job voluntarily a year ago. I had full benefits. I got a very stable job, lots of money. I just quit it because it wasn't fulfilling enough. So there you have your second answer. The first answer is I was making a critique of the fact that locally, meaning at the local level, in the cities and in the region, the five-star movement has done amazing things and has actually applied the concept of liquid democracy, which is you talk directly to the people and you make legislation with the people in a wiki-like environment, and everybody votes on everything. So it's essentially direct democracy on a large scale applied for the first time in human history. This has never happened before. I mean, it did happen at some level, you know, small communities, but it never happened with thousands of people or millions of people. And now that we are the biggest political party in the country at the national level, we still don't have a platform that reflects this thing that we already do at the local level. So my criticism is we should be taking decisions right now at the national level together. And I said, it's a shame that it's not happening. And the staff says basically, we haven't got enough time, the platform is on its way. They've been saying that for years. And simultaneously, there are hundreds of computer scientists who said, I'll give my work, you know, I'm volunteering to work for free to help out with the platform. And none of these people got any response. So I'm saying, use that cognitive power, make the platform open source, so that as soon as possible we can use it at the national level and take decisions all together. And I spoke with some of the members of parliament, and they agreed with me, and they brought the issue directly to the party leaders. So, direct democracy.
The gentleman on stage wanted to speak.